Welcome to What the What. I'm Renee.
Jeff.
I feel so competitive today. Let me just get in that I am Scott.
And I'm still Jeff.
All right. So we are meeting today to talk about very important stuff. I injured my back this past week.
Ooh. No.
Yeah, it was 2 weeks ago. It was bad. I was bending over. So it was very dramatic. I was bending over and I was, my back. So that actually inspired my, what we're going to talk about today. But before we get to that, first question for the group, I wanted to know when there was a time when you realized you were different from other people. When you came into awareness that in some way, looks, attitudes, you're like, oh, I'm not like other people.
I have never felt like I'm like other people.
No.
And yeah. Yeah.
No, really?
Yeah. Early. Yeah.
Yeah. And the weird thing for me is that the older I get, the more that I realize that I'm like other people.
Yeah.
You know, I'm
Ditto.
That's interesting.
Ditto.
I'm an only child. So you start with this unique sort of position, some of us anyways, that like there's nobody else like you in the world and that you're amazing and you build this sort of whole world around yourself and you just kind of look at other people in some ways almost like they're players. I mean, it's very Hindu. It's kind of like they're all players on the stage and they're all sort of there for, you know, you to kind of, not for your entertainment necessarily, but to sort of puzzle out and figure out and, you know, who you can learn from and stuff like that. And it wasn't really until I got into high school that then I started to feel this crush of like, oh my God, I'm probably like everybody else. And then that was a real problem for me. And then I think I've spent the rest of my life trying to like differentiate from everybody else and not be part of the crowd.
Oh, so for you, you were like, I don't want to be part.
I do not want to be like everybody else. And sadly, I know, true confession, I know that I'm way more like other people than I'm different from other people, but I still like that personally, like that distinction is important to me.
Yeah, funny, I've had almost the exact same arc. When I was a kid, like in my trailer park growing up, I was the focal point of all the other kids. I was taller than everybody. Mm-hmm. I was always the leader of our clubhouse, whatever that was. And then junior high, and even in elementary school, like there was always a sense that people looked, you know, my peers looked up to me. And then junior high hit, and I was nobody.
Mm-hmm.
And it was devastated me for about 4 years. I didn't really start recovering from that until I was in my 30s.
So that's interesting. So your trajectory is the opposite. You felt different, and then you realized you may not be different.
Yeah.
So talk about that moment when you realized maybe you weren't different from everybody else.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Sixth grade when I showed up, and all of a sudden everybody already knew each other, and I felt like I had missed out on something. And then I was just like,
did you switch schools? Is that what happened?
Well, yeah. When you go to junior high, by definition, you're going to a new school.
Right. But what usually lots of people go with the same people. Like,
right.
If you're in a feeder school.
Right. So, but then you hit junior high, and there's all the kids from the other feeder schools are there.
Oh.
And somehow they all knew each other, and like I missed orientation, so I think I missed the big group party. But I was just like totally cut out from every social scene. And
I've had a couple times in my life where it seemed attractive to actually like join the group and go with the flow. And those probably for me, they happened when I was young, and they happened around school, which I think happens for, you know, lots of people when they're younger. So for me, when I entered high school, I played football, I was on the wrestling team, like I did all this sort of high school stuff, which anybody who knows me now would probably kind of scratch their head a little bit about, like, you know, why did you do that? And, you know, I started playing electric guitar, and like, which I sucked at because I'm terrible at that and I have musical aptitude. And I was just doing a lot of things at that point to try to fit in. And I literally can remember the day. And it's funny because I don't remember a lot of stuff about high school, and I'm not like bitter about high school at all. I had some good times and some good friends, but I remember the day in the middle of my sophomore year, like sitting out on, we had this quad, like sitting out there and just watching everybody like walk back and forth and go to their classes and stuff like that. And just thinking, it's like, I just want no part of this. Like I am done. with all of this. And I was, I quit the wrestling team because I wasn't enjoying it. I didn't re-up for football. I was a starter, but I was just like, I didn't re-up for football the next year. And it's just like, and I think that that was like one of the first times that I was kind of on, I felt like I was on a track to be maybe a little bit more of an artist and differentiate a little bit and be a little bit different. And then I had a similar experience when I went to college, which was initially, you know, I went in with ripped jeans and dirty shirts and stuff like that and was kind of punky in a way, but not a punk, but just like kind of like that. And then I just realized that I wasn't going to meet any girls if I kept dressing like that. And, you know, so I changed for a while, you know, I like bought shirts with collars and, you know, got a haircut and did all that. And, but it just didn't last very long. And oddly enough in my career, and same thing, I mean, I started wearing, I had like 7 suits, you know. Eventually, I had 12 suits, you know, so I had 5, you know, I had a suit for 2 weeks and 2 extras. And it was just, I just realized, like, I'm just not going to sort of express myself in my career the way I want to express. It was great to start, but I'm not going to express the way I want to express. So I was very much have kind of had times in my life where I kind of railed against myself. Probably a little longer response than what you were looking for. But no, I think, about this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. No. And maybe that's kind of why we're all here at this table, right? Is that we've had a similar experience. But like for me, those earliest memories were very concrete in the sense that like literally having curly hair and nobody else did. And in my family they did, but we all had different curly hair. So like my earliest memories are like, I'm not like these other people. And it was really embodied. Like it was physical for me that there was something physically different. And then I could, and so then hair becomes sort of a symbol for all the ways growing up that I was trying to assimilate into something. Cause you know, that I felt a desperate want to be a part of something, to like, to belong. And then when it wasn't until I was much older, I was like, well, that's not going to work. So I might as well let go of that idea and just like, fuck that and like lean into being different. But, that was like, I guess in that way it was the same, like always knew I was different. And then, but I never had the, maybe I am like everyone else. I was just like, I'm just not, and it's okay. And I'm just going to make peace with that. So, I think we're probably all a little more settled in that feeling now than previously.
Age does that.
It really does. I think. Yeah.
Probably not for everybody, but it's definitely helpful to have some perspective on that.
Yeah. I mean, I started getting tattoos when I was 37. It took a while. Like a lot of people start early and I was 37. I got tattoos, changed my hair. And I was like, yeah, let's just lean into that. But this brings me to my sort of larger point, which is, this is something we've had on the books to talk about for a long time. And we haven't, and I was like, let's do it. Let's dive into this one, this idea of bodies and how bodies are portrayed in media. TV, film, music videos, all those sort of things. And we really talked about this originally as particularly around people who, like heavy people, like fat people, how they're portrayed in the media. But I think there's like a larger question in this about what do we see in the media that's problematic about, or let's start with problematic. Let's focus on that one first. Like what do we see that's really problematic in the media about the human body.
And I just have to jump in and say, this is going to be a 2-part series.
Oh, it is.
Because guess what my subject is
yours
for today.
Yours is as well.
But I'll probably approach it from a different way. So
okay,
let's,
because cool.
I think there's a lot to talk about.
There is
about.
A lot, yeah.
So
yeah,
that's good. I'm glad you brought this up because it's something that we've been talking about doing for a while.
Yeah.
And I was actually at, here in Tucson, what they call the Out Brunch, which is the LGBTQ plus community in Tucson comes together to honor some people who have been influential and allies as well. And one of our podcast listeners, Yobana, was there, and I was talking to her and a friend of hers named Stacy, and they were like, oh, yeah, you should totally do body stuff. So
yeah.
Here we are. So I guess,
here
like,
are.
All these great minds are coming together.
Right. Was this what you were going to do next week?
No.
Okay, good.
No. Not even close.
Okay. All right. Okay. Were you going to say something else about that, though?
I wasn't.
What
it's all on your shoulders. That's it. You have to carry it.
So the first thing that comes to my mind, and this was actually a topic that I did. This was supposed to be my topic, like episode 1 of this season.
Right.
And the reason I kept tabling it and kept shelving it is, particularly when you're talking about like people of size, there is, you know, in some ways, media is just a reflection of our culture, and there is no terminology to talk about plus size people that isn't loaded with values, mm-hmm. and judgments. So like I can't even come up with a word to describe people without without it being a third rail and sound like we're talking shit about, you know, whether it's overweight or plus sized or obese. All of these words are just so laden with values that it's like the first thing we have to do is just agree on how we're going to talk about people without, you know.
Well, there are people who are, there becomes this trend that sort of like, it's easy to obscure the human in the term to say someone is fat, and that loses the person. And then there's this personhood movement that usually is working to reassert that. So then it becomes person first language. And then that tends to evolve into something where they're like, no, let's not, like, we're also going to reclaim this word back. And so like fat is the term I've heard some people saying, like, just agree that it's like, it's fat. Don't use euphemisms. But to that larger point, you know, there's definitely people who don't agree with that and don't want
I don't want to spend the next hour talking about fat people.
Well, and also, and I don't think that's the only thing. I don't think we should only talk about fat people.
Right.
But also, like, I think what's really phenomenal about that concept is the people we see in media who are quote unquote heavy are not fat in comparison to what we see, what exists in the spectrum of humans. So the heavy set people, the Renee Zellweger gaining a bunch of weight to play Bridget Jones' Diary, she became an average size woman to do that. She went up to a size 12 or 14, which is mind boggling because that's average for, so she did a fat role, quote unquote fat role, and it was an average role. So even in media, we're still not seeing bodies that are actually reflecting what is common and average in the, particularly for women. Well, men too. I think that's a barrier for both genders.
And if you think about the terminology, like right away, like you can do this sort of mental experiment, right? And we kind of do that sometimes on this podcast a little bit. You know, you take the term white and black, which are just opposite values on, it's not even the color spectrum at that point because it's monochrome, but it's like one is all light and one is the total absence of light. And yet they have been loaded over time for a variety of reasons with meanings. We'll do that with the words fat and thin, right? I mean, I can't get away from the fact that fat seems like a pejorative to me.
Right.
Yeah.
And thin doesn't seem like a pejorative to me.
No.
Which is really interesting because they are just descriptions of people who might be equally healthy. Like, these people could be equally healthy at opposite ends, or not even opposite ends. They're just on a continuum that's a little bit different. So, yeah, I think it's fascinating. And I think we've been really trained as kids, and we've been trained for a really long time to see fat people as being dumb, as being funny, as being, like, jolly.
Lazy, lack of self-control.
And the funny, one of the things that I happen to know about people who are fat is that often they have more self-control than people who naturally don't have, like, who don't tend to put on a lot of weight,
mm-hmm.
you know, and can eat a lot and do all of those sorts of things. Lots of times for fat people who struggle with it, that's not everybody, because some people are perfectly happy with their weight. But for people who aren't, or their body size or their morphology, whatever you want to call it. But for some people who are fat, like, they spend their whole life, like, dieting and restricting what they eat and stuff in ways that, like, a lot of people don't. So I'm thinking, it's like, man, they've got some of the willpower. And we know willpower is, we could do a whole other topic on willpower and what that's all about. But, you know, the reality is that some of those people have way more self-control than a lot of the people that you walk past, you know, that are chomping on a $5 million bar and weigh 110 pounds.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of misinformation in the world about what constitutes health, what constitutes, and what's, I think, most painful is that there's the medical challenges, but then there's also the societal challenges of it. Like the TV show Shrill, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. You know, this woman just walking by, a total stranger, comments on the food that the main character is eating. And it's a total fucking stranger. And like, what audacity do you have to comment, but on the food that I'm eating as I walk by? I encounter that a lot when I apply salt to my food. Total strangers will be like, start warning me about my blood pressure. It's like, this isn't your fucking, I'm not sprinkling cocaine on my food. Get away. Like, that, you know nothing about my health. You know nothing about the science of nutrition either. So step the fuck off, right?
Well, you know what happens to me? I'll actually be putting cocaine on my food. And people will just, like, come out of the woodwork and tell me that's bad.
Or everybody tries to snort your food.
That's your friends, not my friends. So, you know,
you're the ones bringing cocaine on your food, and you're going to judge my friends.
It's interesting to me that, you know, the whole BMI, that body fat index, you know, like one of the things with this podcast, I'm interested a lot of times in like where this stuff comes from and why we think this way. So there was this dude in 1832 named, it's French, but I think it's like Quetelet or Quetelet. And he came up with this idea of sort of an ideal sort of body size based on observation, which at the time, observational science was much more of a thing than it is now. So I don't think we can totally, you know, skewer him for that. But he was just sort of observing. It's like, oh, here's what, you know, here are what fat people are like and here are what skinny people are like. And he wasn't really, there was no sort of rigorous science to it. And then he just came up with this idea, which has been kind of adjusted a little bit. I think about 1972, there was somebody who actually coined the term. Ansel Keys coined the term body mass index in a paper that he wrote. And then all of a sudden we're all interested in like, what's our BMI. But I know for me, I'm always obese. Like when I do that BMI thing, like I am like so like over the top obese all the time. And, you know, and that's always been a thing for me. It's like obese is another word that feels pejorative when it kind of gets, you know, put on you even. And it's a medical term. I mean, it will go on your chart if you go to the doctor. And I know this isn't anything about media, but that's a little sort of side rail to this, that it's like, well, it's just the way we socially think about this stuff.
It is about media. Cause the point I was going to make is, or I'm going to make it now. I'm just going to go with it. Like it's a feedback loop. So I had this conversation with a professor 25 years ago. They made a comment about, We only think Cindy Crawford is attractive because she's on TV. I'm like, or she's on TV because we think she's attractive. It's a feedback loop. People have particular tastes and their own values and judges, and then they get jobs in media, so they promote those values and judgments. And then we, as an audience, start internalizing those, and then we get jobs in the media, and so we start perpetuating it. It is just this giant feedback loop. And so when you're talking about something like obesity, there's a kernel of truth to there being a correlation between obesity and poor health that gets wildly exaggerated in the media and then in popular culture, which then feeds back into the media.
Yeah. And you know, there's, and I think what's problematic, right, is that, yeah, like the correlation we assume exists, without looking at anything internal to what actually exists within health. There was this really amazing, it's probably like 10 years old PBS documentary where they decided to see if they could make people marathon runners. And so then they did body mass index, and they did a bunch of like, so people who never done any exercise, and they did a bunch of like health tests. And the woman who was the most heavy set actually had the best lung capacity, and she actually ran a marathon. And this really fit, attractive guy, this fit looking attractive guy, struggled and dropped out at some point. So, you know, there's no way for us to know as human beings what's actually going inside somebody. And so then I think, so why do we dislike it so much, right? Like it's not a good measure of health necessarily, right? There are some things maybe potentially, but causation, correlation, right? So why do we use it?
Yeah, and it even has been in our history at different times. Our history as humans, it has been actually an indicator of health. I mean, we are living in a world where for many of us, it's not everybody, but for many of us, like food scarcity is not a problem, but that has not always been the case. And so, you know, there are cultures out there that have looked at people who were larger than everybody else and sort of intuited that they were healthier because clearly, like, these are people who are getting enough to eat and probably getting good food to eat. And even ways of dressing, you know, the men in the end of the 1800s in Europe, you know, if you were a merchant of some kind, you know, you wanted a belly. And, you know, you wanted to leave a couple buttons unbuttoned because it showed that, like, you were actually successful enough to buy enough food to put on a bit of additional weight. So we haven't always thought this way, but I think that the camera has changed so much about this for a whole variety of reasons. I mean, number one, we just get to see a lot of people. And, you know, I'm going to raise my hand right now. You know, I'm complicit in this, right? I'm a photographer and I do photo work. And, you know, I thin people up a little bit sometimes. I thin their faces up because mm-hmm. I know that's ultimately like whoever I'm delivering this to is going to be looking for. I try not to do that in any extreme kind of way, and usually I do it when I'm just sort of like trying to flatter clothes and some things like that. There's some other body change things that I do when I'm doing that kind of pose. I make eyes a little bit bigger sometimes. I mean, it just is like a photographic sort of practice that, you know, we've kind of gotten into doing that. And I've tried to back off of that over the last 5 years or so when I've been a little bit more thoughtful about it. So
have you ever plumped somebody up?
Yeah, I actually have a couple times. Yeah. I mean, you know, with photography, it's funny because the photo is not the person. And so I tell people when I'm photographing them or if I'm working with a model or something like that, I'm really trying to often make them look like they look on their best day. So even if you think about things like I clean up flyaway hairs, I mean, a flyaway hair in a photograph is a body issue. Like their hair is kind of like, you know, they've got some strands that are sticking out in the background. I'm going to clear that. Nobody has a problem with that, right? But if I look at somebody, I'm looking at the photo, and it doesn't appear flattering to me, then I'll go in and do some things, or even if it is flattering, but I can enhance some of that, I'll go in and do that. And sometimes that actually does mean sort of like, you know, filling people out a little bit, like making men's shoulders a little bit bigger, making their chin, like bringing their chins, you know, maybe giving a man a little bit of a stronger chin line. And I know, like, hate me for all this because it is like falling into all of these norms, but they're photographic norms that I'm kind of operating within. Like I said, I do less of that now than I used to do, but I'm not going to say I don't do any of it at all because I still do.
Do you do any?
I'm nowhere near as proficient with Photoshop as Scott is. So, I mean, I could count on one hand the number of times that I've used the face tool to thin somebody's face. It's not because I'm to a minor extent, I'm ethically opposed to it, but it's really more just a lack of knowledge and skill. Mm-hmm. Why I don't do it very often.
I mean, Photoshop has been one of the biggest perpetrators of this particular phenomena, right? This that Photoshop has then involved into filters and is involved into this way of us really altering how we look in the world. And that is, and maybe what we're moving to is we all just upload an avatar that we totally control, which is interesting because I think that would be very character revealing about who we choose to put out there into the world. But yeah, it's been a big part of it, and I know there's been a recently been a somewhat huge push against the Photoshop phenomenon, particularly because there's Photoshop fails, but also there is this falsehood that's being created in a way that in some ways actually, like, I'm not really against a falsehood, like, you know, where if I wear eye makeup, like, that's an enhancement, right? So I'm not really against those types of things, but it's this larger moment of like, what does it mean for consumers, like, by creating a falsehood, we're also creating a false sense of what's possible in an actual human form, which can be really problematic. But separate from that, of course, is your business, which is where you have to give a person a photo that they like, and they live in a world where they don't want to seem heavier than they are, or, you know, whatever that is, they want that to be reflected.
Yeah, and, you know, the way clothes hang, I mean, there are a lot of things sometimes. If you're doing something, you know, I've done fashion work for a hair salon, like a high-end hair salon, but it ends up sort of being all about the person. So yeah, I'm making the hair look perfect. Well, nobody's hair ever looks perfect, right? Or think about the time that I'm like taking off a zit, right? Should I just leave the zit on? Probably not, right? You know, should I smooth skin a little bit if somebody doesn't have really smooth skin? I take ruddiness out, like, you know, redness, sort of red and things like that. So there are a lot of things that we do, and I'm not sure. I brighten eyes. I whiten teeth. I mean, is whitening teeth a body image? Like, I don't have perfectly white teeth, right? You know, most people, by the time they get to be my age, you know, we've had a lot of coffee over the years, and our teeth aren't perfectly white. But oddly enough, we do in photographs.
Yeah, I do that on almost every portrait I do. I whiten the teeth, and I brighten the eyes, and I sharpen the eyes. I don't enlarge them, but I definitely whiten teeth. And I have like a jacked up grill. I'm very sympathetic to people with bad teeth.
Pupils. You know, make the pupils a little bit bigger. It looks like she's sexually excited or he's sexually excited. I mean, that is...
So where's the line then?
Oh, see, I would actually make them smaller to accentuate the color of the iris. But
I guess that just shows what you're interested in and what I'm interested in.
But where's that line then? Yeah, where do you say too much?
So
you know?
from one of the things that struck me as an anthropologist back in my anthropology days, there is not a culture, there is not a society anywhere in the world at any point in time in history that did not have some concept of beauty or an ideal form.
Correct.
So what's the difference between thinning somebody up in Photoshop versus stacking rings around a woman's neck to elongate her neck in some sub-Saharan African tribe? Either way, like there's always going to be some standard of beauty, and there's going to be some people that don't meet that standard and feel like they're being excluded. I don't think I don't want to exist in a world where we're not allowed to have our own standard of beauty. I just want to exist in a world where people aren't judged and felt like. I think where we cross into a danger zone is when we start making associations between this one particular attribute and start making judgments about other attributes based on that attribute. When we start thinking about making character judgments about somebody being lazy or lack of willpower or not as smart, you know, when we start making those kind of judgments, that's when it really starts being
problematic.
But me just saying I have particular tastes, those are my tastes, and they're not going to change just because somebody says, you know, you shouldn't have tastes.
Yeah, it gets.
Well, I don't know that anyone here is saying that.
No, but you hear that a lot. That is something you hear because people. One of the things people do, and I'm gonna go to a D&D reference that might go over both of your heads.
I'll get out my 12-sided dice.
Fairly certain it will.
So when you're rolling for a character in D&D, you have a certain amount of points that you can distribute among six characteristics, right? So their charisma, their personality, and we kind of have this thought process in real life that everybody has a set number of points, and they just get if you're really beautiful, then that means you can't be intelligent. And the reality is everybody, some people just get shit. And some people are Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah.
And he's brilliant and he's funny and he has a great personality and he's a decent guy and he's absolutely gorgeous. You know?
I've mentioned on here before that I love Warren Buffett. He described one time the fallopian lottery. You know, which is like, you don't know what you're going to get before you come out in the world. And you just like, it's a, you know, another metaphor here, but you know, you're dealt this hand of cards and that's what you've got. And you're right. And it's not very nice. It's not very fair. It's not ethical. It's none of those things because it's nature, right? It ends up, you look a certain way, you have certain attributes. Now, how that sort of is seen and interacted with in society, like that's the interesting question, right? It's like, how do people treat you given how you scored in that fallopian lottery?
And I think, I mean, we did have our conversation about the male body, like the, you know, that was a specific niche conversation. I think what happens is that women feel it's disproportionately projected on them.
Oh, no
like,
doubt.
No
doubt.
So there's this TV show, I watched like a couple episodes and I was like, nothing ever happens on the show. I'm like, this is why I don't like reality TV. Naked and Afraid, right? Two people, they get this, they get a score before they get a man and a woman. They get this score before they're going in. to be dropped into a jungle, and that the score is like, what's the survivability? Like, what have they done in the past that makes it them able to survive in the wilderness? And then they are literally naked with little like pixelated bars to make sure everything stays decent. They're dropped into some weird environment and they live for a month. You either tap out or you don't. They have to feed themselves, clothe themselves, da da da. Great. Okay. They're a month theoretically on their own. And for whatever reason, they found it very important that the women always have the armpit shaved. So the women spend a month in the wilderness and still have no armpit hair. So I don't know if there's any other place where armpit hair would be the appropriate thing. Like,
are you sure they're not just using that to weave clothing?
You do not get that much armpit hair. Because if you
speak for yourself.
Well, I mean, some women might actually, that's true. But like, no, you need much longer hair for that. But like, it's definitely like the women aren't even having to body hair in a show where the premise would be you should be going into nature. Like, and then it was, and once I sort of recognized that there's a woman laying down and she's got her arms back, you know, it's this fourth week and she's about to make it. And I'm like, where's her beard? Like, women get facial hair too. And like, where are all the things that would make her really go look like she's wild? No, she's still coiffed. She's still, and not to say that the guys look, I mean, the guys, you know, some of them, I guess, would grow beards, but they're allowed to grow beards, but women aren't allowed to grow body hair. Like that sort of stuff. I'm like, that's bullshit, right? Like, just go to nature.
If you got that far into that show before realizing it was bullshit.
Well, no, that was the thing where it's like, that's the line in the sand for me. I was like, this is not.
The line in the sand for me on that show was when I saw the commercial and I'm like, no, no.
Yeah. I was just trying to see. And I was like, no, this isn't, like, mainly because it has no plot. But yeah, that was like body hair on women. You know, we can't, different hair types, like different sort of body types. But I think this also goes into, we don't also see people with disabilities. We don't see people in wheelchairs. We don't see people. They had that one character on ER, and that was that female doctor with the red hair, and she had a supportive cane that she wore. They never really explained what that was about, but that was amazing that they had someone who needed some, you know, supports to get through. And it was great, but that's really rare to see that in the world.
Well, and I think that's an interesting thing that I know a lot of people are calling for, which is the normalization of, in the media, of all kinds of people that don't actually need to have some sort of crazy backstory for why they're the way they are.
Right.
Because in our lives, people are often just the way they are because they're the way they are. I mean, it could be somebody who was born with something that was a particular characteristic. It could be somebody who had something happen to them along the way. And like, if it's not even necessarily that important to the story, it's like, why does that have to be important to the story? Why can't it just be that we understand that there are people that are like that? And we tend to fetishize people like that a little bit. So when we actually like have someone who's maybe somebody who uses a wheelchair or somebody who has some sort of like, you know, let's say somebody is visually impaired, right? Then in a way, the whole thing kind of sometimes sort of becomes about them, or the scene becomes about them, and it becomes about that one thing and sort of takes away this sort of whole bubble of humanity that they also have that has nothing to do with that one thing.
Right.
Like, they probably, as a human, people who have those different things going on probably don't always define themselves that way. Like, that's not the first thing they think of, but I think often it's the first thing other people think of.
Sure.
When they describe them to somebody or whatever. So it's not a surprise that the media acts that way, but there are a lot of people who are saying, you know, really, does it have to be like this? Or could we just have some interesting people and stories that navigate the world in different ways?
Yeah, well, we're not exploring. The point of the story isn't their difference. It's just that they are different people doing things. Like all of us do.
And it gets really, really tough to do that, I think, without being or without having tokenism. Like, it, like, to me, that would be really difficult. Like, if I was putting together a let's say a sitcom or a drama, right, for TV, it's like, how do you introduce characters that are different in some way or live differently abled, whatever those things, and not have that sort of become the point of that person more than the person being the thing. Like,
who is the woman from The Facts of Life? Did you guys don't remember that? There was one character that was brought in. It was like Blair's cousin that had, I think she had cerebral palsy.
Oh, no, yeah. Oh. And it's probably because I think that's how we used to do it. And I think people were well-intentioned in doing those kinds of things. And
then every episode that she's in becomes a very special episode.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I know, it's so gross. You know, and I was just thinking one TV show that did it really well is Superstore. One of the characters, Garrett, is in a wheelchair. We don't know why. It doesn't matter, right? Like, he's just, you know, he's got his own personality and it's never talked about and he's in a wheelchair. And it's really exciting to see him just rolling around, you know? And I just feel like, yeah, that sort of ability to show people, you know, there's also this movement of, like, neurotypical. Like, we want to show people with autism and different things. There's The Good Doctor now and different ways that people, the sort of invisible disability, some people would say that's part of it, operating in the world as humans, right? And I think that part excites me about the media. But we have a really far way to go. Like, I am currently working at work on a campaign about Latinx communities, and, you know, there was a big push. iStock, Getty, they did this huge push a while back to show different body types and different ages and weights and, you know, just all sorts of things that we could do. But, you know, I'm looking at, can I find a Latino family where...
In Tucson? Good luck.
No, like a Photoshop Latino family in within stock photography, a Latino family with a kid with a disability, a kid with Down syndrome. That's not in stock photography yet. So I can find a white family with a kid with Down syndrome, but I can't find any other representation.
Scott, get to work.
I mean, I can't even tell you. I mean, granted, some of this
producer Anna's making notes right now.
Yeah, like, I would really, like, cha-ching. That doesn't exist. And if it did, I would buy it. I would absolutely buy it because I need families of all types and colors are doing things, and we just don't have enough representation out there for that.
Yeah, there's been in stock photography, which for anybody who listens knows that I've been involved in doing stock photography for over 15 years now, I think, something like that. And, you know, it's changed so much from very sort of character type people that represent sort of a whole spectrum to a much more sort of naturalistic, I mean, still stylistically kind of cool and interesting, but, you know, much more sort of naturalistic settings and naturalistic people. So there's more of an emphasis, but photographers need to catch up with that. I mean, there are literally millions and millions and millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of stock photos out there. And everybody, you know, anybody who does it seriously is trying to figure out, you know, what should I be doing? So, you know, somebody somewhere needs to pick that up and do it. And if just nobody, there's nobody's going to wake them up in the morning and push them out the door and make them go do that. But if they figure out that they can make money on it, right, because it's part of what we do for a living, then people will start to be a little more earnest about that.
Yeah, I will buy it. I will buy that. Anyone listening?
All right, stock photographers.
I will buy that photo. We have so many pictures of women laughing at a salad. We need more options. A white woman laughing at a salad. That's kind of one of the ongoing.
Salads are innately humorous.
They're so
I don't know what your problem is.
Hilarious.
I've seen Scott shoot that photo.
I actually have. Yeah. At the desk with the salad.
No, God. Yes. We don't need more of those.
I did it on purpose.
Okay.
I
good. Mean, that, you were making
and
fun
I do
of
have
that
dudes
trope.
With salads doing the same thing.
Okay,
so
good.
Standing at the desk, cheesy grin, salad. And it's funny because that never gets me on awkward stock sites, but I've got lots of other images that do. And I was thinking, oh, this will get me there for sure, right?
Awkward
I guess
stock
the girl
sites?
Is that. You know, awkward stock. You ever heard of awkward stock? Yeah, there are sites out there. It's a little bit of a left turn from our topic, but there are sites out there that just sort of go out and they find like really weird stock photography and then they'll have awkward stock. And I have a few images that routinely show up on awkward stock, including, and maybe appropriate for this, fat man with lollipop. So I've got this guy in this like wife beater t-shirt. Was I just not PC again? Fat man, wife beater, and eating a lollipop. I know, I'm sorry, hate me. But it's funny because people will ask me, like, I've been interviewed, like, why did you do that? And I'm like, because I had the guy in the studio and I had a lollipop. I handed it to him, took the photo, and I said, oh, by the way, you bought it to use for this article. So, you know, cheers that, right? So,
you're like, so I gotcha. Anyways,
it, you know, sometimes you're just in the studio shooting stuff and you just hand somebody a lollipop and you go, here you go, and you take the photo. And sometimes it's an awkward stock photo. So, and who knew, right?
Love that. I went and buy all my stock from awkward stock photos. I would actually build a campaign around... Okay, separate. Build it. That's what we'll do for this. What the what campaign? If yeah, we do perfect. Any marketing, yes. We'll do awkward.
Since we're all pretty awkward.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a quick break, actually, and then when we come back, we will talk more about bodies. Okay, we are back from break. I hope you enjoyed hearing Scott talk about Anchor. So the second half, we didn't delve too deep into the dark, but for the second half, I want us to talk about what representation we see that we do like. What films, videos, music, TV, music videos have you seen where you felt as if it was doing something new, different, or interesting with human bodies?
You know, there was a movie with Philip Seymour Hoffman that was called Jack Goes Boating. And not many people saw this movie. Amy Ryan, who was in The Office and played Michael's like girlfriend, she was in this movie and played a straight role. And it's this very little indie movie. And I just remember when I watched that movie, I always liked Philip Seymour Hoffman. And, you know, he's a dude that is not the same shape as... not the same shape as many of these sort of Hollywood leading men and stuff like that. And he didn't typically play like a typical kind of leading man. And I just really liked the way he portrayed the main character in this movie, which was just like a guy with not a gigantic life that just like had this kind of awkward romance with this woman. And that was really kind of about it. And it was not about, it didn't have anything to do with his appearance or her appearance. And they were very believable. And it was one of those situations where you felt like the two of them could be together. Like in the real world with all its weirdness and whatever, like they looked like they made sense to each other, and the characters were played in such a way that the characters made sense for each other. And so I just really, I remember I really liked that movie when I saw it, and I've often thought back on it. And that Philip Seymour Hoffman was a pretty amazing actor.
He was.
So there's one scene in that movie where it hangs on his face for long time. I'm going to say 20 seconds. You know, 20 seconds on the screen is like forever. And he does nothing. And there's one moment where he just like kind of sighs like a little bit and gets like just a little bit smaller. And that's all it is. And it's like breathtaking. So, you know, it was such a tragedy to have him lose his life the way he did. And really, we lost, like, I think somebody was really a great actor when that happened. But that movie, Jack Goes Boating, if you haven't seen it, it's worth seeing.
It's a romance.
Kind of. Yeah. But it's
love story. Maybe.
Yeah. It's definitely a love story. I don't know if I'd call it a romance. I don't know if it fits all of those, you know, sort of tenets of exactly what a romance is.
Sure.
There is a kind of a romance in it.
Okay. Uh-huh. All right. I will cautiously put that on my list.
Nobody tears anybody's bodice off. I'm just saying.
Okay.
I do think it's interesting that the answer to your question, and it goes straight to a guy that's portrayed, because like you got to... I'm racking my brain trying to think of somebody, of a woman, of a plus-size woman that was portrayed even neutrally in any kind of media without it being focused on her body. And, like, I got to go all the way back to, like, Roseanne Barr and the Roseanne show, where it just showed it, their body types was never a focal point at any point of that show. It was just... These are average Americans. This is an average American life, and this is who they are. And so it just kind of portrayed it neutrally. Like, but I can't think of, I'm struggling to come up with anything since then.
Well, and I guess the question is like bigger than that, in the sense that it doesn't necessarily mean that they don't talk about the weight, like, but that they're still doing something revolutionary about bodies.
Right. And we're supposed to be talking now about like positive, but I can't think of anything where they were talking about weight. Even in movies that was trying to promote body positivity, where it was still undercutting their message. Movies like Brittany Runs a Marathon, Shallow Hal, which is just trash.
Oh, that's anyway. Bad. Yeah, that's not a good one.
I Feel Pretty, the movie with Paris. I was about to say Paris Hilton, but definitely not her. Oh my gosh, she was in Cats.
Yeah, Rebel Wilson.
Rebel Wilson, yeah. The you know, Isn't It Romantic? Like all these movies are like supposedly like are focused on their sizes and we're supposed to be promoting body positivity, but every one of those movies ended up undercutting their message throughout the movie.
In what way? Talk a little bit about that.
So the most recent one was Brittany Runs a Marathon, but before that, Isn't It Romantic? You know, it was all about just the whole message of the movie was love yourself and accept yourself for who you are, but you're also going to date within your weight class. And every one of these movies, the person, even when they come to love themselves, loving themselves really means you're not going to get Ian Hemsworth. You're going to get the chubby guy at the next cubicle. So that's still, you know, it's, yeah, love yourself for who you are, but know your place. And that seems to be the recurring theme in all of these movies. I literally can't think of one that just portrays, and maybe I'm not, and I watch a lot of movies, but I can't think of any movie that I've seen recently where it just portrayed heavy set people and just positively or even neutrally. It either makes their size the focal point of the story or it in some way undercuts their message.
And even like in Shrill, which is really getting held up as a great example for people, the weight is central to the story of Shrill, which is on Hulu. So
yeah.
I think one of the things that you're asking is like maybe somebody for whom like they just show up on the screen, they're a little bit different than everybody else, and it's not necessarily an issue because they're humans having a human life, interacting with other humans, and it's not just about their size.
Not necessarily. Like, I think that's kind of what we're working towards. But like Shrill, I feel is a very good example of really, because sort of the other issues I had with those films that you were mentioning is what they do is they'll be like, girl, love yourself. But you still live within the patriarchy where you're kind of like substandard, right? Like, so it totally ignores the patriarchy. And I mean that as like not, you know, the system, right, which oppresses women for what they look like and punishes them for that, right? So like, it's kind of a ridiculous notion to be like, if you just thought you were pretty, you know, you could be a little happier is what it's, you know what I mean? But that's a false bill of sales, right? Like that's not the case. You may not advance in your career just because of your weight. Like there are legitimate real life consequences to being heavy set. And in that sense, I feel like Shrill does a very good job of actually just looking at that and tackling that and being like, yeah, it's not as simple as just love your body. That's not that easy. And you know, she has a very tense relationship with her mother. And that part is, you know, really painful to watch, but it feels like it's really, so I feel like that is one of the few narratives, and that's based on Lindsay West's work, is really good at deconstructing the patriarchy in a way that like a film like that, you know, Brittany Runs a Marathon, which I didn't see, but like one of those films is doing. So that's, I feel like that's a good one.
I was just thinking about Kathy Bates, who's been around for a long time. And I really like Kathy Bates as an actress. And like, she manages to just have presence. Right. And she has like, and she can play a lot of different roles, and she can be very funny or very sort of straightforward or kind of scary, you know, depending on what your particular genre of Kathy Bates is. and her stuff tends not to be particularly body focused, you know, it's just more about, and she's been on the scene for a really, you know, for really quite a while. So I was just, you know, as we were talking, kind of racking my brain to come up with somebody who doesn't sort of, you know, where it's kind of not about their shape. If they're not the normal shape, I'm sorry, I said normal. If they're not the sort of statistical middle of the road for shape, then it tends to be about their, you know, a lot about their shape. And funny too, because it is true that if you go in the other direction and you have people who are very thin, it's often not about their shape. We don't even really kind of comment on it. But definitely, you know, when you get above the sort of statistical norm, which, by the way, 60% of Americans would like fall into that category of being fat if you're looking at what the norm is for that. So, you know, the norm is actually really different than it's being portrayed in the media. I think we've said that.
Yeah. So. You know who else I think does a really fan? Melissa McCarthy. She just plays characters sometimes. Like, she's just the character is the character is just who she is, and it's not connected back to. So she often picks roles where she's like spoofing a certain type of person, and some of that is maybe connected to weight, but like she as an actress, I think, is just good at just doing the role, and she's highly entertaining. Like, do you watch any of her stuff? Like, it's
so funny. I know who she is.
Oh. Yeah, I guess it's not really your jam, those types of comedies. Oh, I know. But, The Heat is one of the best buddy cop films, ever. Her and Sandra Bullock, who's surprisingly comedic.
There was one Melissa McCarthy movie I saw, and I reviewed in 2018, and it made my list of worst movies of the year. It's the one where she went back to college with her daughter. I don't remember what it was called. It was just terrible.
Yeah. Well, she made one bad movie, but...
Yeah.
You know,
it wasn't about her weight, though, right? Was it?
No.
Right? Yeah. There you go.
I watch a lot of British, Australian TV.
Same.
And it's interesting to me that like, they will have a character, like maybe a detective, who is just, like, fat.
Yeah.
And it's not like Columbo. Like, remember back in the... No, I'm sorry, not Columbo. Canon, right? Mystery Theater. For anybody who's old enough to remember... not Mystery Theater. Sorry, I'm getting this wrong. So, like, Saturday Night Mystery, whatever. So it was one of the shows.
Saturday Night Fever?
Not Saturday Night Fever. Oh. Leave me alone. Okay. I'm doing just fine here. So. It was like McLeod and McMillan and Wife and Banachek. There were all these different shows that kind of rotate. Columbo, and there was Cannon. And Cannon was fat. And he would occasionally, they'd have him like trying to chase some bad guy or something. And he just couldn't, they played it relatively straight. But it was a funny era because it's like every detective had a thing. Mm-hmm. And Cannon's thing was that he was fat. Yeah. Like, you know, Ironside, which was a little bit before. Ironside was in a wheelchair. Cannon was fat. McMillan and Wife were married. McLeod was a cowboy. Like, they each had sort of one... like, major sort of, like, personality thing. It just happened that with Cannon, the personality thing was that he was fat. Well, now, you know, fast forward to now, and there are these British mysteries like Vera. And Vera is just, she's this very, very normal, played for Dowdy, in a way, kind of woman. And she just owns it, and she's great, and it's funny, and you really like her. And there's sometimes a little hint of like a little sexual tension sometimes with the guys who work with her, you know, that are kind of into her a little bit because she's pretty cool, although they never really develop that out. And it's just like, it's really nice. And it's one of those situations where it doesn't, like, she's not having to apologize at all for being a woman. She's not having to apologize for her size. She doesn't have to apologize for the way she dresses because she's super fucking competent, the character.
Yeah, I find that British TV is British, and hopefully they keep this trend. They're less interested in putting a really pretty person in place. Like, they're willing to have the detective be a little rough. And
they don't have a choice. they don't have Miami or Los Angeles, so...
They actually will throw somebody.
England felt that England is like from just far away is like, oh, we just had this pain in our chest. We don't know why.
Right. First Brexit. Now Jeff. That's what they have to deal with.
Well, God bless them, because that means their TV feels more. And now, granted, if you look at Doctor Who, there's not a lot of great. They're also fine with Daleks looking like trash cans, right? So, like, they have a different bar, but I find that bar refreshing because, yeah, they'll put someone in who's a little rough cut, pulled from the, you know, the wilds of England, wherever they're from, and I find that really refreshing. Yeah, I really appreciate that about British TV.
We're both looking at Jeff. Just alienated a continent. Sorry.
Well, yeah, and then what you'll do is you'll watch an American.
I didn't alienate the continent, just the country.
Just the island.
Yeah, then you'll watch an American TV, and it's interesting because I think one of the phenomena that happens within American TV is that everyone starts looking rather general. They're very skinny white woman with dark hair, Wearing heels in a role in a job where you're like, no one wears heels doing that fucking job. You're on your feet all day out. You're digging in anyway, like they'll have these extremely highly stylized, attractive people, and you think that is not reality.
And it's let us say weird that they work in offices that look like they came off the bridge of the Starship Enterprise,
yeah,
right?
Very
and
fancy.
If you've ever actually walked into a police station, yeah, just, you know, newsflash, police stations don't look like that.
So gross, yeah. Yeah, those CSIs. Yeah, I guess they take place in Miami. Yeah, I find that really boring at some point, right? Like, just narratively, not as interesting to have.
Homogenous.
And then I can't tell them apart sometimes. Like, visually, I have a hard time being like, wait, which one is that? And so I think that sort of distinction and having that, like, variety is a really exciting part of modern TV. No, we're not really getting it in TV, I guess. Oh, is that everything we need to say about this until we do part two? Jeff is like, no, we've made no progress as a society about this.
No.
We haven't?
No. I don't know. I mean, I didn't know we were supposed to be fixing anything today.
No, I'm just curious if whether or not you think there's been any progress.
I don't know.
I will, in the next episode, speak of three waves.
Three waves.
Of sort of body acceptance and where we are. So I will put on the sociological hat. I will steal it from Jeff and put it on my head and speak to that.
Okay. Oh, good. Then I can tell him where he's going wrong. That'll work.
But he'll be wrong. I'll be right, as usual.
This will end in an arm wrestling match. Okay, so what are you into this week?
So you can go over to Bandwagon Fans on YouTube and check out some reviews from some movies so far this year. Invisible Man, I really liked. Mm-hmm. Invisible Man, it was pretty good for most of it. And then I'm working on a review right now for Seaberg. But I'm taking my time on that one because that's going to be a full takedown of the inaccuracies of that movie. So I'm really, really taking the time to dot my I's across my T's on that one. So
I feel though I've been an influence since we're actually like, you would probably do this anyways, but since you're going after historical inaccuracy in movies, which we know is like they're all inaccurate because you can't be historically perfectly accurate. But in this case, it sounds like from what you said when we were off mic and before this, like they were inaccurate on purpose and that deserves a takedown.
Yes.
I'm excited for that. I can't wait. I haven't seen the movie. I kind of want to go see the movie now to kind of see how it's going to get dinged.
I honestly, I would recommend people go see this movie, Seaberg, because it's a very, the subject matter needs to be known, but you have to go into it armed with actual knowledge so that you're not misled by some of the things that they try to pull in the movie.
It's a great point. You know, a lot of times I go and sort of do a search after I've seen the movie to check it out. But probably it's worth, if you want to be armed, like actually arming yourself with a bit of information before you go in.
Yeah.
So that you can even kind of catch when you're being manipulated, when the filmmakers are attempting to sort of manipulate your view of what happened, right? I know what I'm into.
I'm not doing that. Yeah.
I'm into this podcast called Boomtown, which is on, it's put out by Texas Monthly, which is a periodical, and Imperative Entertainment. And it's just really good. It's a look at the Permian, which is the area around Midland, Odessa, Texas, and there's an oil field there. And it's in this huge boom right now. So it's just basically about kind of what's happening there in this boom. It's a 10-part series. I think I'm on number 9 right now, so I'm just about to the end of it. And it looks at all kinds of different things, like how that came about, sort of what's going on. This happens to also be the home of the Permian Panthers, who were the subject of Saturday Night Lights. And so, or Friday Night Lights, Saturday. See, this is what right. time, when do football teams play? And is it
Friday
football
Night
or
Lights.
Was it rugby? Or anyways, Friday Night Lights. So anyways, happens to be the subject of
I was like, did they do a sketch? sketch. SNL do a sketch.
No. So actually that high school is there. So one of the episodes of this is just about that high school and the football team and kind of how football is received there. But it's just really good. It's really interesting. It's well done. They spend a couple episodes are just on sex business in town and how that kind of comes in with the boom and sort of like what that's about and from people who are involved in it and doing it in all sorts of different ways and stuff. So it's just really fascinating, very interesting. Talks to an economist at some point who's not so sure that boom's going to hold up after all. And so it's really a fascinating listen. And if you like things that are about Americana, American towns, American people, this is just sort of uniquely this slice of America. And it's really fascinating.
Did you, just as a side note, did you watch that Netflix episode Cheer?
No.
It feels like it might have a similar effect. We'll talk more about that. I just started it. I'm not sure if I'm going to stick with it because documentaries. But yeah, it's sort of like a slice of small town life.
Oh, I would like that. Yeah.
Ooh. On another note, talking about small town life and Americana, I highly recommend people go see Once We're Brothers, Robbie Robertson and the band.
Oh.
It's a documentary that's out right now about Robbie Robertson and the band. And it is really cool.
Oh. Okay.
It's really, really, really like paint by numbers, like VH1 Behind the Music kind of storyline. But it's an undervalued band that's incredibly influential in American music. But most people today don't even realize who they are.
Robbie Robertson and the Road Road Ensemble. It's the same guy, right? Who did? Okay, sorry. LSF. Yeah. So the thing that I'm into this week is actually this is from last week, but. The Black Lady Sketch Show, a Black Lady Sketch Show, which is an HBO series where four comedians, female comedians who are black, put together a sketch show. It is hilarious. I finally decided I was going to get some HBO. I was going to watch The Watchmen. I was going to watch Barry. I was going to watch all these things that have been getting a lot of hype. And then I realized I don't have the stomach to watch any of those things that are that intense. And so I just happened to find a Black Lady Sketch Show. It is brilliant. It's some of the best comedy I've ever seen. Not only because they occasionally are creating comedy that's very specific to a black community, which is really refreshing to see, but also just that they sometimes it's universal. They have ongoing sketches. They did something really clever where they continue to revisit certain jokes. And so they have stuff that's really fresh, but then they'll continue to sort of build punchlines. And it's extremely exciting. So if you have any access to HBO or if you don't, go buy this series. It's like 8 episodes. It's not a lot. And I hope they renew it because it's very good.
They may have been influenced by Little Britain, which had that same sort of sketch comedy, not with black people, but a couple guys play all the roles and they revisit the characters
so
and just
funny.
Build
yeah.
on the same joke and build on the same joke. And they really do a brilliant job.
It's
so
funny.
We'll have to check. You said the name twice, but I'm guessing it's only
a black lady sketch show.
Got it. A black lady sketch show.
Or the black lady. Something like that. I'm not sure. Yeah. So
the black lady sketch show.
Yes. That's the good way to find it. All right. Cool beans. So we are available in this podcast, but obviously
everywhere in the universe.
Everywhere.
Everywhere. On Mars.
We are on.
Can you get us on Mars?
I'm there. Done.
Anna, work on that. Get us on Mars.
Producer. Oh, she gave us a thumbs up.
Oh, we're getting projected on Mars.
There's no
our logo
there. We're not,
on the planet.
We're not getting more listeners that way. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Those are linked in the show notes, by the way.
At WTW Popcast.
Pop like you do a balloon.
Cast, yes.
Popcast.
And then we all have our individual things, but for the most part, find us on Facebook, Twitter. And this
because
has been,
we're there.
That's where we are. So this has been Renee.
Scott.
Jeff.
This is what the what?
What?
The
Jeff what? Say what?
Jeff never does that.
Yeah, I don't know why you guys were thinking that was gonna change today.